It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host Veronica Rickert is off this week. Coming up later, we'll talk about the feelings and emotions of moving to a new place, and we'll ask for your stories as well. First, recent numbers from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources show that the fatal chronic wasting disease is on the rise in the state's deer herd. The 2014 CWD testing season ended yesterday. Patrick Durkin is with us to talk about how bad CWD is here in Wisconsin. He's a full-time freelance editor, writer, and outdoors newspaper columnist. He's also the president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Pat, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Nice to be on again.
Well, you've been following CWD for a good long time now. What do you see in these latest numbers from the DNR? What are they telling us about chronic wasting disease?
Well, I guess the biggest thing they're telling us is that it's getting as bad as some people were predicting as many as 10 years ago. And basically, the numbers for a number of years when we first found CWD were kind of low. And I think they kind of, for a lot of people, just kind of stopped being a concern. And then starting about 2009, you look at the charts, and I remember writing about in 2009, you could just start seeing quite a few areas in southwestern Wisconsin where it just started climbing faster and faster. And now this year, what's I think one of the more interesting things is they're showing that in some of these areas that originally had very little CWD but had a few positive cases show up, the rate of the increase in those areas is going faster than it was in some of the original areas where they found CWD. So what that means, no one really seems to know right now, but the trends are all going in the wrong direction.
And in a recent piece, that's half of what worries you, these rising numbers. The other half is a decline in the amount of testing the DNR is doing.
Yeah, it's been a real obvious choice the DNR has made to cut back on testing. And I remember when, basically about 2009, that time period, many people in the assembly, it wasn't just the DNR, but people, some leaders in the assembly were calling for cutbacks and funding for the testing because they didn't think we were learning enough from it or seeing enough results from it. But, the thing we always talk about is that science is a slow-moving process. Typically, you don't get to the bottom of a lot of these diseases, whether they're human diseases or animal diseases, until you've been pounding away at them for a while. So I thought all along they're way too impatient and cutting back on this stuff. But right now it's not just Wisconsin, but nationally too, it's hard to find funding even for the universities to go out and do more research on chronic wasting disease.
Now give us a quick 101 on chronic wasting disease. What is it and how does it affect deer?
It's basically, for lack of a better term, it's a brain disease that once they get it, it's fatal. It basically creates holes in their brains that, and once they get it, they typically live about 19 months. And they really, even then, when they have it, don't necessarily show symptoms until they're right near the end, their final 2 or 3 months, when they start losing all their, they start losing their balance, they start drooling. They will often just, if it's winter, they'll seek a warm spot to sit and just reserve their energy by sitting in a lighted area. Or even there's even cases where the DNR has been called out to people's homes where they sit below a vent to the outdoors, from the furnace, where they can keep a little extra heat there. But like I said, once they have it, it's always fatal. There's no recovering from it. And they don't die in big numbers where they're easily found, like some wildlife diseases do. They typically die one by one, oftentimes in secluded areas where nobody finds them. Then the scavengers pick them apart and scatter the bones, and you never really knew there was ever a deer there in the first place.
We're talking to outdoors columnist Pat Durkin about the latest news on chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin's deer population. This has been a story that's going on for quite a while now. Are we getting to the point, Pat, where this is a threat to the deer herd that hunters are going to see, that this is going to affect the population and change hunting in the state?
Yeah, it's always tough to know for sure how visible these kind of things will be, because if you watch and listen to hunting issues every year, especially deer season, we've already been hearing complaints for as long as I've been writing in the outdoors, 30-some years now, that every year you hear that, there's not enough deer out there, we're not seeing enough deer. So when you actually do start seeing a decline, it might not be something that you really notice is actually a proven occurrence. It might be, it's oftentimes been perceptions in the past, but I think the numbers show that when you're losing, like right now in some areas, there's like 25%, 40% of the adult bucks, have this disease. And when that happens, you can kind of figure that, well, it's about 25% of the available bucks of a year are going to die before hunting season ever comes around. So, you're going to see a declining number of deer, and you're definitely going to see a declines in a number of mature bucks. You know, that bucks can't live past, 4 years old, whatever it might be. You're not going to see some of these huge bucks that we've sometimes seen from southern Wisconsin.
What has the DNR done to try to tackle CWD?
Well, initially they were aggressive. You know, they came out and really were encouraging people to shoot as many deer as they could, and they're putting sharpshooters in certain areas where the chances of getting sick deer, were increased in those targeted sharpshooting areas where they really would kind of go for the areas with the greatest odds of killing sick deer. They really did a pretty effective job in some areas of getting a higher percentage of sick deer than you would ever get through random shooting by hunters. But that was controversial because, people didn't like the idea of the DNR being out there and shooting deer and then taking away opportunities for hunters later in the year. And so, you had a situation where a lot of hunters didn't want to see the long-term good of controlling this herd for the long term, not just for their own temporary enjoyment.
So that's been dialed back over the last few years?
Yeah. DNR basically doesn't do sharpshooting anymore, and they've backed off really a lot in the actual hunter-killed deer, too. You don't see as much, you don't see the aggressive earn-a-buck-type program anymore in the CWD area where you had to shoot two antlerless deer before you could shoot an antlerless deer before you could shoot a buck. So the herd will be increasing now as far as actual numbers. But the fear when you start letting the herd get large is that you're going to have even faster transmission rates as more deer are out there, possibly spreading the disease.
Now, as I recall, we have a law regulation in the state saying you can't bait or feed deer. I think that was because of CWD. They didn't want deer congregating, spreading the disease. There have been calls in the legislature to end that, at least regionally. Where do you see that going?
Yeah, that's an interesting development this year. I think most people were accepting of the fact that it's never good to congregate deer anyway. So originally that was a compromise to start with, even allowing baiting and feeding anywhere in the state, because for 1 year, like in 2003, we didn't have any, it was illegal statewide to feed deer and bait deer. And then the legislature came in again and basically modified that to where, okay, we'll allow it, but only in areas where we haven't found CWD. Well, now some legislators want to change that, making it even less aggressive, and less coverage on that. And so I don't know. I just don't see the sense in that when you can start potentially putting deer in close quarters at the same sites over and over again. And then if there's a sick deer among them, the chance of spreading the disease. Because, one of the things that's tough about the whole issue, though, is we really don't know for sure how they spread this disease to each other, but it makes sense that they're probably somehow doing it through contact, either through their food or direct contact with each other.
What have you heard from wildlife biologists about the rates that we started talking about, these higher rates of CWD mm-hmm. in deer? Are they worried that we're at or maybe past a tipping point here?
I'm not sure what tipping point. And I really don't know what they would consider the tipping point where it's beyond hope. But I know when these numbers start jumping up in the 20% range and 30% range, biologists like Robert Raleigh from the DNR and I know Tim Van Dielen, you talk to any people like the university, they're all pretty concerned about these numbers going up the way they are. Typically scientists don't like using terms like frightening. So like when I heard Robert Raleigh at a public meeting, use the word frightening, that caught my attention because he's typically a pretty conservative researcher, doesn't get too emotional about stuff.
And again, in that piece that I mentioned earlier that you wrote, you were kind of signaling that the DNR was downplaying these numbers that you're seeing as alarming.
Yeah, I don't understand this. This is something I noticed last year in the whole way they go about reporting their findings. They and then actually it's been going on not just, you know, people always want to say it's the Walker administration, the current administration. I think it's increased as far as how they're controlling the output of the information, you know, in the current regime. But back in 2009, too, it wasn't like the DNR was putting out press releases saying, hey, this disease is now jumping at unprecedented rates. But now we're, you know, 5-6 years into those when I first started jumping up pretty fast. And now it's really accelerating fast in some areas. And you still see in this most recent press release they put out, really downplaying. I mean, they just buried the information in the press release, put it in the middle of a package of press releases. And basically, if you want to find out, the information is all there on their website, but you have to go looking for it and comb through it and kind of figure out on your own what these numbers are and what they're representing.
Pat, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Appreciate it, Rob.
That's Patrick Durkin. He's a freelance editor, writer, and outdoors newspaper columnist. He's the president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, with us to talk about the latest numbers from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources on chronic wasting disease among deer here in Wisconsin. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Springtime is decision time for the college-bound. Dean Robbins, in a moment, will reflect on his own decision to move to Madison and how that decision shaped him as his son prepares to leave for college. And we want to hear from you, too. Call in while this is playing. At some point in your life, did you make the jump and move from outside of Wisconsin to Wisconsin, or maybe move from a small town to a city or the city to a country? Did your new home come to shape your identity or leave you feeling like a stranger in a strange land? Give us a call with your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
After growing up in St. Louis, I wanted to settle down somewhere smaller. I liked Midwestern college towns, so I narrowed the choices to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Madison, Wisconsin. I hadn't been to either one, and this was the 1980s, before you could find out about a city by Googling it. So I looked at a map and arbitrarily picked Madison. Maybe because I'm left-handed and it sat to the left of Ann Arbor? I packed my belongings in my old Volkswagen and drove north, with no contacts and no job prospects. I've been thinking about my move to Madison because, 3 decades later, my son is graduating from high school here. It's strange to look back and realize how profoundly my life was shaped by this place I found by chance. When I arrived in Madison, I noticed stacks of eccentric newspapers around town. I'd never seen anything like them in St. Louis. They covered the city's thriving alternative culture, from indie bands to political debates. I quickly went native, throwing myself into all the activities I'd been reading about. I even got a job at one of those eccentric newspapers called Isthmus and started writing about local alternative culture myself. I met and married a fellow writer who'd also come to Madison by chance. We had a son in 1996, the one who's now graduating from West High School. My son's personality has surely been affected by growing up in Madison, with its lakes, its capital, and its university. I've watched him gravitate toward the arts, which makes sense in this arts-loving town. He discovered drama from classes at the Children's Theater of Madison. He learned how to play guitar at our neighborhood's Monroe Street Fine Arts Center. He saw Seth Meyers at the Barrymore Theater and Bob Dylan at the Overture Center. Every summer, my wife and I took him to the Isthmus Jazz Festival on the Memorial Union's legendary terrace. He and his lifelong friend Eli hopped around by the stage, got snacks in the rat cellar, and fed the ducks on Lake Mendota. As a native, my son takes his Madison identity for granted. But as someone who came here in his 20s, I marvel at how the place has transformed my adult life, transformed it in a way that a kid from St. Louis couldn't have imagined. What would I be like today if I'd driven my Volkswagen out of Missouri to Ann Arbor instead of Madison? Who would I be married to? What job would I have? It's impossible to know, but the version of me that developed over the past 30 years can only think he lucked out by picking the left-hand side of the map. I hope my son is just as lucky as he heads off to college in the fall. It's another place chosen more or less at random, in a city he knows almost nothing about. I can't wait to see how that undiscovered locale shapes the person he turns out to be.
Dean Robbins is a writer based in Madison. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, check out wisconsinlife.org. Well, now it is your turn. Did you have an experience like Dean Robbins, one that brought you to a new place, a new city, town, community, somewhere in Wisconsin or elsewhere? What brought you there? Did you come to identify yourself as a member of that new community? What seemed weird to you? What turned you off about the new place that you lived? What took some getting used to? Call 800-642-1234 and share your story. That's 800-642-1234. You could also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And you've already been starting us off through the day on Facebook. Patrick wrote in, "I moved to Wisconsin for the love of my wife, 38 years ago. Congratulations, Patrick, on that. And Barb wrote on Facebook, "I'm from Chicago. My mother was from Park Falls, Wisconsin, so all our summer vacations were in that station wagon heading up north. I loved being here so much. I always loved the North Woods and Wisconsin culture, and I always knew we were getting close to home when I'd see the Miller High Life sign." Well, how about you? What is your story of relocation? Moving to a new community, maybe someplace you didn't know anything about. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. We've got Wendy with us now in Oshkosh. Wendy, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to share my experience. I moved from Seattle to Tokyo, Japan, and then moved to Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And it's been a very interesting transition.
I bet.
Living in Oshkosh was like a culture shock, sort of like landing on the moon. If you can imagine, Seattle is a very liberal place, and Tokyo is a very international place. When I came to Oshkosh, I found myself feeling like I was the only non-religious person, liberal in the town. So it's been an interesting transition.
Well, how long have you been in Oshkosh now, Wendy?
Now about 14 years.
14 years. So it didn't chase you out. How did you settle in? How did you make it your home?
Well, my children grounded me there, and knowing that I wanted to provide some stability for them, I decided to stay. And now they're sort of almost out of the house permanently, hopefully. And so I'm really looking forward to going anywhere. I don't know that I'll stay in Oshkosh, but it's been a great place. After I settled in, there's a lot of really lovely people there, and it's a good place. And Wisconsin's an amazing, beautiful state.
Wendy, thanks a lot for the call. I got to imagine the sushi maybe isn't quite as good in Wisconsin as it was in Tokyo, though. Back to our callers, we've got Judy on the line in Ripon. Judy, hi.
Hi. My husband and I moved about 30 years ago from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We both grew up there, to a small town in central Wisconsin, which is Ripon, Wisconsin, a small college town. And my mother kept saying, "Oh, they'll be back. But we never did. We really decided we loved Ripon. The thing that's the neatest about being in a small town is that you can have widely different political viewpoints than your neighbors. And because it's such a small town, you do have to learn to get along. So it's just the best of all possible worlds, because you've got all kinds of differing viewpoints, and you really do have to live the respect that you have for other people.
Judy, Milwaukee to Ripon, did it take some getting used to that first year or two?
Oh, a ton of getting used to, yeah. But we easily decided that we loved it there, because, you know, people know you by name in the bank, people know you by name in the drugstore, people, you know, it's a wonderful, wonderful place to be.
Great. Well, Judy, I'm glad you found a home there. Thank you so much for sharing your story. We're taking stories of moving to a new place. We've got Sigrid in Madison now. Sigrid, hi.
Hi. I grew up in Wisconsin. I went to the university. I moved to Kansas City, where I met my husband, and then we had a 30-year career in Washington, D.C. that included living in Moscow and Budapest, and actually my husband worked for the State Department, and there's a mandatory retirement at the age of 65, and we were sitting in Budapest. And I got a University of Wisconsin alumni magazine, and they were advertising a condominium that was being built in downtown Madison. And I wrote my husband a letter saying, I followed you halfway around the world. I'm moving to Madison. You can come if you want. And he had never been in Wisconsin, lived in Wisconsin. And we have been here now for 10 years. We love it. What we loved about Madison is that it has a very nice European feel where you can walk every place, outdoor cafes, beautiful architecture like the Capitol, wonderful culture, good medical care. And we live downtown, and we love it. We've been here for 10 years. So my husband, as I said, who had absolutely no connection, has just really enjoyed being here and all of the activities that he's been able to find at the university. I think, you know, great cities have great universities, and great universities and that kind of clientele demand great food. So
All right.
We have great restaurants.
Sigrid, thank you so much for sharing that story. We'll leave it there. Thank you for your calls and your comments. You can keep sharing your stories about relocating to Wisconsin, back to Wisconsin, within Wisconsin, over at the Central Time Facebook page. A new study finds some troubling news that may not be a surprise for the state's motorists. Tens of thousands of miles of the state's local roads are beat up in need of immediate repair, and with local funding gradually decreasing over the years for the repair of those roads, the authors of the report say something has to change. They're calling on the state to prioritize these roads over new highway expansions. You could join in with your thoughts on this. Are your local roads in rough shape? If you're in local government, is the money there to fix these roads, to maintain them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Joining us now to talk about the problems facing local roads in Wisconsin is Steve Hinneker, Executive Director of 1,000 Friends of Wisconsin, the group behind this report. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob, for having me. Appreciate it.
So according to this report from your group, our local roads in the state are in crisis. How bad are things?
Well, we took a look at the state of local roads in Wisconsin throughout the state using DOT information. And local roads make up about 90% of the roads in the state, a little bit over 90%. And of those, more than a third are in need of immediate attention, with way too many in a failing or poor state. This is probably something that most drivers already know as you move around in your community, but it's actually a worse problem in rural areas. Rural areas in the state have up to 45% of their roads in really bad shape.
And what does this cost Wisconsin as a community, as a state, and as drivers?
Well, you know, there are kind of annual per capita numbers that are out there that make it a little bit difficult to make it meaningful for the average driver. But what it does cost is, we know that it does cause damage to vehicles. Sometimes it causes crashes and personal injury crashes, and it devalues the community. Property taxes are lower when there's buildings and residences on poor roads. So we're really in a state where we're falling behind as far as quality of life in communities, as well as our ability to just keep up with our existing infrastructure.
And yeah, in this report, you're making the case that the money hasn't been there for these local roads, and that in part that the money is going to new highway expansion instead. You see this as a big problem?
Sure. You know, when most people go to the gas station, they fill up their car with gas and they pay their gas tax. And they also, in the mail, they mail in their registration fee for their vehicles. And there's a reasonable expectation that a good chunk of this money is coming back to the community where this tax was generated. But instead, what we're finding is that communities are relying more and more and more on property taxes to pay for local road maintenance. And the tax dollars that we send off to Madison end up going for highway expansion, not even necessarily the routine maintenance of highways, but big mega projects like the proposed widening of I-94 in Milwaukee or I-90 between Janesville and Madison. And the problem is that local governments, when they rely on the tax property taxes, they're under a situation where we have a virtual property tax freeze in the state, and other revenue sharing is down for communities. So when you get to the local level, you're really you have your hands tied behind your back. It's pitting road maintenance against fire trucks and police and libraries and schools. And so what we're saying is that we should go back to the promise that the state made when they came up with a formula that said up to 85% of local road costs would be reimbursed. But we're only reimbursing somewhere below 20% of the actual costs of road reimbursement in the state. The rest is coming off of property taxes.
Talking to Steve Hinneker with 1,000 Friends of Wisconsin, making the case that our local roads, our rural roads especially in the state, are in rough shape. They're not getting the money that they need for maintenance, in part because the money is going to big highway projects in the southeastern part of the state in particular. You can join in. How are the roads where you are? Do you think enough money is going into them? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to a caller now. We've got RJ in Sturgeon Bay. RJ, hi.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. What do you think?
A couple comments. First one is, I think an interesting way to maybe generate funding is to have corporations, which are citizens, pay maybe 1% for towards infrastructure of whatever their take is during a normal year. The second thing is about the expansion. I'm kind of new to the area, and I was in Green Bay a couple weeks ago. And I was in Beijing, and Green Bay is the most complex city I've ever had to drive in. I don't know what they're expanding for, but the fact that they're building such huge overpasses and things like that goes to what you're talking about.
RJ, thanks a lot for the call. Steve, RJ saying a new business tax on businesses that use the roads. You're saying, it sounds like, Steve, maybe not a new tax, just using the current gas tax money differently.
Yeah, we do. We already do have enough money that we're collecting. You know, the problem is that when we get into these multi-billion-dollar projects, there's just not enough money left over to pay for local roads or the maintenance of our existing roads. So if we had a little bit of discipline in the legislature over what we were approving as far as road projects, we would have more than enough money for communities to fix the potholes and things like that. And we would see a few less examples of what the caller just talked about, the kind of overbuilding that we need. So we're saying that we don't really need any new taxes. It's just a matter of prioritizing.
Back to our callers now. We've got Nick on the line in Greenfield. Nick, hi.
Yeah, hi. And thank you for taking my call. This is something that's been on my mind for quite a while. You mentioned, your guest mentioned rural roads, but he should come into the city of Milwaukee as well and ride up and down some of the streets. I mean, they're in such terrible shape that they feel like you're in a Conestoga wagon going down a couple of wagon ruts across the prairie. I would like to have some of those legislators in Madison come over to Milwaukee and just ride up and down South 60th Street and see just how rough that street is. I don't even take it anymore. It's so rough.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. Steve, rural roads you mentioned, downtown, whether we're talking downtown Milwaukee or the smaller cities, are we seeing problems there too?
Oh, it's, absolutely. In fact, this study came about because of our experiences driving in Milwaukee, Sherman Avenue, some of the other streets that we've been on. They're in horrible shape, and it's really not the city's fault. It's the fact that they're not getting the reimbursements for the cost of road repairs. So when people have their shock absorbers fail or a tire blow out, they should call the state legislature, not City Hall. But the problem is urban, it's rural, it's everywhere.
Thanks for the call. We've got Stephanie with us next in Madison. Stephanie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
I wanted to comment a little bit on that person from Sturgeon Bay. He's absolutely right. If you drive from Madison up to the Fox Valley and up to Green Bay, there are it's a very expanded road, and there are these overpasses that almost mimic what they have in Milwaukee. They kind of go off to the side and up and way over the highway. And the last time I drove up there, I thought, where are these large overpasses going to? They're just driving into nowhere. They're driving into rural farms and rural areas. And I thought, wow, this place almost looks like it's downtown Milwaukee, yet there's nothing that it doesn't go to anything.
Stephanie, thanks a lot for the call. Steve, you know, isn't there a case to be made for where you've got major population centers? Talk about, you know, Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay, our top three biggest cities. You need a big infrastructure. The infrastructure paves the way, paves the way for economic development down the into the future. So it's that's ultimately going to benefit the state tax roll. So this is an investment that could pay off down the road.
You're absolutely right that we need to invest in our highway infrastructure as well as our local roads. The entire network is important to all of us in the state. But the problem comes is when you have an out-of-balance system, when you put too much weight on the freeway system, especially at a time when we're driving less. I mean, this is not something new. Yeah, we had a little blip of an increase this past year in driving, but we're still below 2007 levels, and we're still about the same level of driving in the state as we were back in 2004. So if we're not increasing the amount we're driving, we ought to be concentrating more on the maintenance of our existing highways rather than expanding highways that aren't really needed. We did a study of over a dozen road projects in the state that were done since the year 2000, and not one single project has come close to meeting the projected traffic levels that were used to justify the construction of that road.
Time for one more call. Rick in Grafton is with us. Hi, Rick.
How you doing? I drive all around the state, and I hadn't been to Madison in a long time. And over the weekend, I drove to Madison. I couldn't help but think about how great a shape the roads are. Is that a reflection because it is the capital and all the politicians are there, or is it just my imagination?
That's really interesting. I doubt if it's really a because legislators are here. If anything, I think that there's a little anti-Madison bias in the current legislature. But you're absolutely right. What we found is that Dane County roads were among the best-kept roads in the state. And, you know, this is a study that we completed about a week ago, and we haven't been able to figure out why Dane County is in better shape, and the city of Madison is also has a little bit better roads than most other places.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Steve Hinneker, Executive Director of 1,000 Friends of Wisconsin. Coming up next, we'll shift gears. It's really hard to avoid driving and road metaphors, by the way. We'll hear another angle on transportation in the state with a guest who says modernizing Wisconsin's interstates should be a priority going forward, and we should consider toll roads, and Congress should let us do that as a way to pay for it. Right now, we're continuing talking about transportation in Wisconsin. Our next guest says that here in the state and elsewhere, a large and growing fraction of the interstate system is nearing the end of its original 50-year design life, and the state must look to the reconstruction and modernization of these highways in the coming decades if we want to keep reaping the benefits from them. That raises the question of cost, and it's one he thinks could be solved, in part, through the use of toll roads, something Wisconsin has not really embraced in the past. Once again, you can join in with your thoughts on this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Robert Poole joins us now. He's Director of Transportation at the Reason Foundation. He's advised four presidential administrations on transportation issues, and he's explored the issue of toll roads for the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Rob. Good to be here.
Well, let's start with the state of the interstate. How are we doing here in Wisconsin and around the country?
Well, Wisconsin is doing a decent job of maintaining. We rank 28th among the 50 states in terms of the condition of urban interstates, which is, you know, okay. But the problem is, as you said in your intro, many of these highways in Wisconsin were built 50 years or a little more ago. And when a highway that's designed with a 50-year life gets much beyond that, it's really more cost-effective in the long run to reconstruct it, to basically rip up the pavement, reinforce the base, put in new, more modern pavement that will last longer and be easier to maintain, and rather than continuing to spend money on maintenance. And this is to say, over the next two decades, just about all of Wisconsin's interstates, except any that have been rebuilt in the last 5 years or so, will need to go through this process. And our estimate from a big study that I led in 2013 is that the total price of doing this would be $7.7 billion.
For Wisconsin?
For Wisconsin, yes. It would be close to $1 trillion for the nation as a whole, the entire interstate highway system. Now, you got to realize, I mean, the interstates in Wisconsin handle 21% of all the truck miles of travel and 18% of all total vehicle miles of travel in the state. And, you know, we tend to take these things for granted. You know, for most of our lives, they've been there. We can use them. The goods movement, the trucks use them. But if they really start wearing out and they're not in good shape, then it's going to be very difficult for the function that they're carrying on. It means a lot more traffic is going to be on other roads, and the other roads are probably not designed for the heavy amount of traffic, especially big truck traffic. So that's why we came up with the idea in the study of looking at toll financing as a way to do this. There is no federal program that's going to provide $1 trillion of funding for rebuilding the interstates over the next two decades, or even $7.7 billion for Wisconsin. And to do it in the state by yourself would require a very major increase in some taxes, the fuel taxes or other taxes, and that's probably not politically acceptable. So I think it's worth having a serious conversation about toll financing them one by one in priority order. You know, the ones that are worn out the most would go first, but all of them eventually would go through that process.
Well, people have been talking about a lot of ideas to raise money for roads here in Wisconsin. You mentioned gas taxes. There have been others. Nobody ultimately likes any of them. It seems enough people like them to do them. But if you're having a popularity contest among Wisconsinites, toll roads, not high on the list. Do you think that this is something that could be sold to the public?
I think it could be. There was actually a Marquette University study last year that I wrote about in my newsletter that gave people a list of like five or six alternatives, if, you know, on the premise that we do need to invest more in the highways and which is the least bad way to do it. And tolls came out, I believe, top in that poll. And that kind of result has been found in other states. If you ask people, do you want tolls, they'll always say no. But they'll say that if you want, do you want a gas tax increase? No. Do you want a sales tax for roads? No. You have to really ask them to compare the alternatives. And also, people in Wisconsin probably don't, unless they drive a lot down in Illinois, probably don't realize that nobody in starting to do tolling today would ever build a toll plaza or a toll booth again. It's all done nonstop, electronic, at highway speed. And this is not your grandfather's toll road.
So do you want to make the case, is it a better way to pay for roads, apart from popularity, pay for roads with tolls than by increasing the gas tax? Say?
I think it is for two reasons. First of all, with toll roads, you would finance the project up front. So in other words, the year that you need to start doing it, you'd raise the money, and all the whole amount needed for the project would be there, and then you pay it off over time. It's just like, instead of waiting to buy a house, waiting until you've saved up the entire amount, or building it in dribs and drabs over 20 years as you accumulate enough to add a room, you finance the house purchase and pay it off as you enjoy the benefits of it over many, many years. It's the same principle as how toll roads are financed. And the other thing is that the people who buy the bonds that the toll revenues are paying off insist that in order for the road to be popular and people to use it, that it's properly maintained. So they require legally there be maintenance accounts that get first call on the toll revenue, so that you can basically guarantee that the roads that are rebuilt with as toll roads would have their own built-in funding source for maintenance that would be there regardless of what else goes on with the state budget.
Talking to Robert Poole with the Reason Foundation, he says, one, a lot of our highways need replacing, their total teardowns in the next decade or two. Two, we need to pay for it. It's going to be expensive. And three, toll roads should be on the table to help do that. What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Robert, a big roadblock here is we can't do this right now. Congress won't let us. What would have to change to actually make this a possibility in the state?
Right. Well, Congress this year is supposed to reauthorize the whole Federal Surface Transportation Program. And so some of us are urging Congress to liberalize the current ban on tolls on existing interstates, with it being limited exclusively to states that voluntarily decide they want to do this, and it's totally for reconstruction only. It would not be as a general funding source, and the tolls would be limited only to the capital and operating costs of the rebuilt interstates. If you put those conditions on it, I think there's a decent chance that Congress might pass that, given that they don't have much in the way of it. They're not going to come up with much new money to hand out to states. So if they can give states something that would enable them to do self-help, like use a new mechanism that's currently illegal, they might well be persuaded to do that.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Jeff on the line in Hub City. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. I see this as nothing but an attempt. It's basically a corporatarian approach to privatize the roads and make everybody pay for roads that we already paid for. You know, look where this guy's funding is actually coming from, and it's coming from super rich people who want to parasitize off the system. It's wrong. It's completely wrong-headed thinking.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Is this an attempt to make private profit off of public roadways, Robert?
I don't think. A private concession alternative is one way in which the projects could be done. But there's no, you know, lots of states have state toll agencies. So the toll finance mechanism is perfectly useful and suitable, whether it's done by a public sector or private sector.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Marcus with us in Green Bay. Marcus, hi.
Hi. I'm in Green Bay here, and last year in Appleton, they just passed a wheel tax. And I believe it was like $5 a wheel or something along those lines. And it's just basically, you know, when you register your car, it's going toward that community's local road maintenance. However, what I'd like to see it implemented on a statewide thing, as well as including bicycles, boat trailers, snowmobile trailers, construction outfits that have multiple trailers and multiple vehicles. You know, maybe once you get to a certain amount of axles, it's prorated at a different charge or something. But what, is there any... been anything looked into something along those lines?
Marcus, thanks for the call. So, in effect, a user fee could be a per wheel rate, as done in some towns, but it's a user fee instead of a gas tax or a toll.
Yeah, well, I'm all in favor of user pays approaches like that, and I think certainly for local roads, that's an innovative idea. I didn't realize anybody had actually implemented that, and I think caller may not realize that on toll roads, trucks pay a much heavier, much higher rate. Typically, a heavy truck pays about four times the rate per mile as a car because they do a lot more damage to the road, certainly. The road has to be built a lot thicker and stronger in order to handle trucks without them tearing it up. So they impose more costs, so therefore they definitely should and do pay more.
Marcus, thanks for the call. A twist that I think I saw you mention at one point, Robert, is the idea of refunding gas taxes while people are on these toll roads.
Yes, this would be very difficult to do with old-fashioned cash tolling, but with electronic tolling, most of it's done with people set up an account, and so the tolling agency or company knows who you are, and when your car passes, you know, you could just basically look up the EPA miles per gallon, figure out how many miles you drove on the toll road, and therefore how much gas you use, and therefore how much Wisconsin gas tax you paid. And they could just debit your account or credit your account for that amount of gas tax. So you're only paying the toll and not the toll and the tax for the miles you drive on the toll road.
I don't think I'd seen that before. Robert, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Very glad to be here.
That was Robert Poole. He's Director of Transportation at the Reason Foundation, talking about toll roads as a way to pay for the highways of the future.